1 o'clock. Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and let's get right to our Metro News segment, our Friday News Roundup with our WFPL Roundtable. Gabe Bullard, Philip Bailey, Devin Katayama are here in the studio. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hey.
WFPL Environment reporter Erica Peterson will be joining us shortly by tape from Eastern Kentucky. She's taking part in an EPA tour of communities affected by coal mining. We'd like to hear from you, of course, if you have some thoughts on the issues we're discussing this hour. The start of school, the U of L hospital merger, the purchase of Insight Communications by Time Warner, the aforementioned coal mining issues. Call us at 814-TALK, that's 814-8255, or toll-free 1-877-TALK, 1-877-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org, and we're on Twitter, WFPL News, and also on Facebook. Devin, let's start with you. Highly anticipated start of JCPS classes in light of the problems that occurred on the first day last year. Of course, everyone was all geared up for Monday, August 15th. That didn't happen because of the big power outage over the weekend. They waited 2 days. Finally, things got started on Wednesday. How'd it go?
Yeah, 2 days. I mean, this was a highly anticipated event, if we can call it that. The Saturday storms knocked everything out. People were waiting to see what was going to happen. I think JCPS actually made the right call when looking at how important communication is during busing and transportation of students. And it seemed like the first day of school went rather smoothly, especially when compared to last year when, you know, as most people know, the last student didn't get home until after 9 o'clock. This year, the last student was reported to be home by around 7:15, 7:20, depending on different news medias. But overall, it went somewhat smoothly. And I'm talking specifically about the transportation right now. Rick Capel, the director of JCPS Transportation, says it usually he's hoping to take about within 2 weeks, he'll have it down to where every student will be home within 68 minutes max.
They made a lot of changes over the past year, right? Spent a lot of money on enhancing communications and other actions.
Yeah. I mean, this year, you know, parents had access to a bus hotline, which apparently the first day or the first few days had over 1,200 parents calling in to find out where their child was which bus route their child was supposed to be on. They also invested in a bus online route finder, so parents can now go on JCPS's bus finder and you know, find the closest bus and what route their child is going to be taken on.
I was one of those 1,200 parents that called up on the first day. They were very helpful. They answered the phone right away and directed me. Our bus was a little bit late.
Something actually, interesting about the bus system in Jefferson County that I think is important to remember as well is that parents can choose to have their child picked up and dropped off at a different location. Other districts, drop off and pick up their students in exactly the same spot every day. JCPS parents can choose if they have daycare in the morning and they want to go to a different parent's house in the afternoon. So the communication is really a big issue, which is what I found out. So JCPS transportation is always dealing with new routes and new information from parents, and so that's why the communication during the blackout or the outages was so important.
And we have a new superintendent now. She came on board just in time for the start of school. Where was she on Wednesday?
Donna Hargens was making her rounds to around 4 Jefferson County public schools. In the morning, she was at Wagner High School. She seemed very eager to begin the new school year. At the end, she ended at observing the dismissal of Brandeis Elementary School. She last week introduced the 90-day plan, which basically sets up the structure for the rest of her time here. In the first 90 days, she's hoping to meet with community members, with everyone on the school board, with teachers, to set up the structure to make a nice, strong goal for student achievement.
What are we going to do with these? How are they going to calculate these 2 days missed? Will they add them on to the end of the calendar?
Still, they have to run that by the school board, but they have rough ideas at this point, but they're still trying to figure out how exactly they're going to be doing that.
All right, Devin, thank you. We'll come back to you shortly. Let's turn to Gabe Bullard. Gabe, a milestone this week and the Louisville Orchestra's Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing.
Yeah, the case is essentially out of bankruptcy court at this point. A judge has approved the management's reorganization plan. That's despite an objection from the musicians themselves and from a musician's pension fund to either not accept the plan, delay the plan, what have you, any of the options that the judge could have taken. So it's out of bankruptcy court. The judge, Judge Stossberg, said this was never really a bankruptcy case. He always said it was a case that ended up in bankruptcy court, but there were so many other facets to it as far as, you know, the whole arts element of it, but then also the labor relations element of it, this feud between the musicians and the management, that it ended up in bankruptcy court because it had to, but it wasn't the cut and dry sort of bankruptcy case that often goes into that court. By approving the plan, the judge has set forward how the orchestra will continue to operate. They're going to, very similarly to their previous model, rely on ticket sales. They're going to rely on grants. They're going to rely on donations to continue going. The only thing is they have this deal in place, and it's 3 weeks until the season starts, but they don't have a contract with the musicians.
What's the status of that? Are there talks?
Yeah, they are in talks right now with the Louisville Labor Management Committee. They're acting as the mediators between these two sides. The management has proposed this tiered system where the musicians would be assigned to a various tier, and each tier would be signed to a different length of contract. They've rejected that offer. They say it makes the orchestra too small, that it would hurt the performances of the music. They say, both sides say they're ready to negotiate. The musicians say they're ready to strike a deal as soon as something that is favorable for them is put on the table. They're very silent about any details of the talks, though, on actually what goes back and forth. But the first show is scheduled for the 10th at this point.
So if there's not a contract, is there a possibility that the season could be dark and that the orchestra could just sit out a season?
Yes. The orchestra CEO Rob Berman was quick to say after the hearing on Monday that he never said there could be a dark season. He says, yes, it's a possibility, but he wasn't trying to argue that in court. He said he wasn't trying to use that as an argument. But he says it's very possible that that won't happen. There won't be shows, that there may be a partial season. He then says there's a number of things that the orchestra does that doesn't involve musicians. These are a lot of the things that the orchestra really may be known for in certain communities, but is not widely known for across right. The city. When you think of an orchestra, you think of an orchestra performing. But they do various things, a few things in schools. They have a charitable gaming wing and all that that will not involve the musicians.
A lot of moving parts with this case. I covered part of the bankruptcy hearing on the other day. I thought my head was going to explode. Everybody, there's a dozen attorneys there, and there's the pension fund, there's the musicians, there's the union, there's the orchestra and the management. It's very complicated.
It is. There were a lot of parts to this, like you said. And one interesting thing that kind of rose up at the end was this pension fund case. The head of the pension fund, or the pension fund, had filed saying that if there wasn't a contract and the plan was approved, the reorganization plan, then the orchestra would owe $3 million in a penalty fee to the musicians' pension fund. The judge rejected that. The judge approved the plan but did not say they would have to pay this $3 million. I talked to the head of the pension fund, Mr. Ray Hare, and he said, you know, he hopes that a deal is reached, but if a deal is not reached, they're going to try to get this penalty enforced either way. They had sought to have the endowment opened up, the $7 million orchestra endowment, to pay part of this fee. But Mr. Hare says that they're considering possibly taking this to district court to try to get their fee if, in fact, a contract isn't signed within a certain amount of time.
And finally, Judge Stossberg, I think, said the other day he had some other options, none of which were very optimistic.
Yeah. He outlined what he could do. He could have rejected the plan, and that would have opened it up, given a very short window for all the other creditors in this case to file their own reorganization plan. So the musicians could have submitted their plan for how the orchestra should reorganize. It could have also been converted, or it would have been open to someone filing to have it converted to a Chapter 7, a liquidation. The orchestra would have to sell off its assets, a little more than $300,000 worth, as outlined in their reorganization plan. If that happened, that would essentially be the end of the orchestra. There could be some legal wrangling over that endowment. But when that was brought up, the judge himself brought it up before he made his ruling, and he said, yes, that's an option I've always had, but that's not an option anyone wants to take. So he said he never really gave it that much thought.
All right, Gabe Bullard, thank you. Let's turn to Philip M. Bailey, our political editor. And Philip, a somewhat unexpected development this week in the case against Metro Councilwoman Judy Green.
Yeah, well, what happened is that Derwin Webb, Councilwoman Green's attorney, had said that the councilwoman was hospitalized, that she checked herself into a hospital on Monday. What makes this interesting is that Mr. Webb admits that he hasn't spoken to Councilwoman Green in a week, that he received that information from Councilwoman Green's husband, James Green. that it is a serious condition. He filed a motion with the Metro Council Court on Tuesday asking for an at least 30-day continuance as she is under a doctor's care. That, obviously, the Council Court has already granted an extension and scheduled the removal trial that she faces for September 12th. For that reason, many were beginning to question, particularly the prosecutor, Attorney Greg Hovius, wanted to see some evidence of Councilman Green's illness, whether a doctor's note, medical records, an affidavit that remained sealed. Mr. Hovius said that he said yesterday when the charging committee met that he wouldn't mind if those records were sealed, that he's not trying to disclose Councilman Green's illness to the public, but if she wants another extension, some evidence must be provided. Mr. Webb said that the charging committee is more interested in removing Councilman Green from office than her personal well-being, but he says that he will provide that information.
Has there been any, of course she's entitled to, excuse me, her medical privacy, but has there been any indication as to what illness she may have or why, or was she in the hospital?
No. At this point, it is an undisclosed condition, an unknown facility. Mr. Webb, when I talked to him yesterday, said that she is in a doctor's care, but that he reiterated that he hasn't spoken to her in about a week, but that he's receiving this information in daily conversations with James Green, her husband. So no one really knows what exactly is wrong with Councilman Green. So we're all just sort of sitting waiting to see whether he will provide some information to Mr. Hovius or to the Council Court. At this point, because I believe Mr. Hovius is filing his response motion today with the Metro Council Court, Councilman Kelly Downard, who is the chairman of the court, sort of acts as the judge. He says that likely what will happen, the council will, when they meet next week, the full council, the council court will meet probably about an hour before the full council does, deliberate both motions and vote by majority vote on whether to extend the removal trial by another 30 days.
And the trial, you may have mentioned, is set right now for early September?
Yeah, September 12th is when it's scheduled for now. That's the two ethics charges that Councilman Green faces, the first being over the Green Clean Team, the second being over 100 black men. The accusation that she rerouted money through 100 black men, the first accusation that excuse me, that she used that Green Clean Team program to benefit members of her family. The Ethics Commission has already ruled in both cases that Councilman Green deliberately violated the city's code of ethics. They slapped her with a letter of public reprimand and public censure. That's the first time that a public official in Metro government has ever received those two letters, and they also recommended her removal from office. So as she faces those two charges from the council court, it would take a two-thirds vote to remove her from office. As she faces those charges, this illness sort of could put the trial back into October, at least, according to Webb, because when they asked for the motion for the 30 days, it's not clear how long Councilwoman Green would be under a doctor's care, when she would be better and get out of the hospital. It simply says that at least 30 days in order for Mr. Webb to confer with her and get together their defense.
When is her seat up for election again?
Well, she just was reelected in 2010. So her term does not expire until 2015 is when the next person would be sworn in, or she could run again and be sworn in. So it still isn't clear. For example, if she were to resign, I think state law would allow her to run again in a primary, but Councilman Green has reiterated time and time again that she is not going to resign, that she's not going to step down, that she feels that she maintains her innocence and feels that she's done nothing wrong. She's already appealed both of those Metro Ethics Commission decisions in Jefferson Circuit Court. Those are still pending. So at this point, I mean, we're all sort of, like you said, it's another interesting turn in what's been over a year-long controversy.
This is really uncharted territory.
Yeah, it's the first time that a council member has been impeached. It's the first time that a removal trial has been scheduled. It's the first time that the council members have been sworn in as a court. There's a lot of firsts for a young Metro government. And I think because of that, you see a lot of questions about what the Metro Ethics Commission can do. I know that Commission Chairman Jonathan Ricketts excuse me, is trying to come up with some ideas as far as putting more money into the Ethics Commission to give them an actual staff member, to give them subpoena powers, which they currently do not have. The Council Court has subpoena powers, but the Commission itself does not. So this is, you know, because it's uncharted territory and we're going down, and I think a lot of residents and lawmakers are learning some things for the first time.
All right. Thank you, Philip. This is State of the News on WFPL. We invite you to join our conversation as we discuss the week's events. 814-TALK, that's 814-8255, or toll-free 1-877 8255. You can send us an email if you'd like, news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet. We're at WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. I want to go back to Gabe and Devin, because you both covered this strange story of the Australian man who was accused of in this bomb hoax in Australia, but was arrested this week here in the Louisville area.
I'm glad you actually brought in Gabe, because Gabe initially covered the press conference with the FBI, so I wanted to start and actually ask you about that.
Yeah, it was an odd situation. I hadn't heard anything stateside about this case at all. It had all happened in Australia. The man was accused of breaking into a house and putting a bomb around a teenage girl's neck, or something around a teenage girl's neck, with saying it was a bomb. Those were the accusations. It's not something that really made a lot of news over here. But then on Monday afternoon, the newsroom phone and the email starts lighting up with calls coming in from Australia saying, we understand the collar bomber has been caught. They different places had different nicknames for this for the suspect, and they started calling in. At first they were saying the police had arrested him inside of Louisville. The details were not really coming out too much. We got from Metro Police that it was an FBI case, that it was not actually in Louisville. It was outside of LaGrange. And so that evening, the FBI called at their field office in the East End and a press conference around 7:30, 7:45 or so. They called the media out, and not a lot of people in the press really knew what was going on. We had had some time to actually look up what the case was, what these allegations were, but the FBI announced, along with a member of the New South Wales police force, that they had caught this man at his ex-wife's home in LaGrange.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a huge story over in Australia. I had no idea how big it was until you know, ABC called and wanted to talk to us about it. But over there, it's just nonstop, and this is a big deal. And you could tell the initial court hearing was Tuesday, and half the court was just filled with Australian reporters. And so you could definitely feel how big of a case this actually was. So Tuesday was the initial court court appearance for Paul Douglas Peters. He's a 50-year-old Australian man, and these are, you know, he is accused of what Gabe said previously. The initial court hearing was to we should be clear that there are no criminal charges brought against him in the U.S. So the initial court hearing was a complaint filed to start the extradition process for Australia, and that's under the 1974 extradition treaty between Australia and the United States. So what the Australian government has to do now is they have 60 days to file a formal request for extradition. And what that is, it's basically they're gonna be getting their facts together for what was in the original warrant in Australia, and submitting those to the U.S. government. At which time, the courts and the government will decide whether or not to allow extradition.
What's his connection to Louisville? Why was he here?
His ex-wife lives in LaGrange, and they've been split up for a number of years. They have some kids together, but she is his ex-wife. At this point, she is not a suspect, and Scott Cox, the attorney for Mr. Peters, has asked for everybody to, you know, respect her privacy at this time. She was not there at the time of the arrest when the FBI was in LaGrange, and they haven't come forward to say that they found anything at her house either at this point.
So he's accused of planting this fake bomb on this girl and demanding ransom for its removal?
Yeah, it's really bizarre. The amount of evidence that they have against him or against this suspect is substantial. They have a flash drive which was around the bomb, or the bomb hoax, that has his first name and initial on the flash drive, saying it was made from a computer from this person, Peter, you know,
Paul Douglas.
Yeah, Paul Douglas. And he created a email account from a Chicago airport, and the same day he was in that airport, or an email address was created in a Chicago airport the same day that he was in that airport. So there's a lot of evidence that is against him at this point. And they'll be using that to try kind of get the extradition process going.
And to make it even more unusual, there's a movie out right now about a case in the U.S., I believe, based on a real case where someone had a bomb around his neck. It was real, right?
Yeah, and that movie, I think it what is it,
30 minutes or less.
Was that about this case, or was that a different case, very similar?
A similar American case,
yes,
inspired it.
Where the bomb actually went off, and the gentleman unfortunately was killed. But I believe he eventually was involved in this particular crime. I don't know the details of it, but This is all very bizarre.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks, guys. Philip, let's go back to you. Speaking of bizarre, let's check in with the Kentucky election campaigns.
That's always bizarre.
And new ads this week from Mr. Peepool running for Attorney General.
Yes, Todd Peepool, the Republican candidate for Attorney General, he debuted his first television ad. Usually your first type of ad, you know, just introducing himself to the voters. He's the Hopkins County attorney. So unlike incumbent Democratic Attorney General Jack Conway, who ran for, you know, U.S. Senate last year, ran for, you know, Attorney General, ran for Congress in Louisville in 2002, Todd Peepool doesn't have the same amount of name recognition. So his ad really just was the first introduction of him. I think Gabe pointed out it was interesting that in one of the parts of the ad, he was walking away from a crime scene, like he was literally behind police tape and walking out of it. These ads are a little bit of showmanship and a little bit of exaggeration. I think that was one of them. So for many people, I think the race for attorney general is becoming the main race, as Senator Williams is behind Governor Beshear by at least 24 points in the latest polls. I think many people are beginning to focus their attention on the attorney general's race because, you know, Jack Conway lost to now Senator Rand Paul last year pretty convincingly. Many Republicans feel that Conway is vulnerable. Many also believe that, you know, if you look at the backing that Mr. Peepool has, you see a lot of support from U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell. I believe Mr. Peepool's, the campaign chairman for him is Larry Cox, a former advisor to Senator McConnell for about 25 years. McConnell's done a few campaign fundraisers for Todd Peepool. So many are beginning to focus on this race, I think, as maybe the silver lining in the GOP ticket.
And also, you mentioned David Williams. Now, his campaign manager stepped down, but he's not going to replace him, right?
No. Last week, Luke Marchant, who came in from U.S. Senator Mark Rubio's office, he was going to be, Senator Williams' campaign manager, in many ways to sort of buoy Tea Party support for Senator Williams, who came out of a, you know, GOP primary with a little bit of lackluster victory there. Marchant was seen as getting Tea Party support, garnering that, and helping Senator Williams out in that aspects. But for some reason, for professional reasons, at least what the campaign said, he stepped down. Many were wondering who was Senator Williams going to replace him with. Senator Williams has now announced that he won't have a campaign manager for the remainder of the race. He will have a campaign committee. Essentially, all the advisors and consultants, Steve Robertson, former campaign manager Scott Jennings, and others will give their expertise, as Senator Williams has pointed out. For Mr. Williams' opponents, particularly his critics in the Kentucky Democratic Party, they have pounced on this, saying that, you know, Senator Williams is going through the seven stages of grief, first going through denial and anger and now acceptance. And they've pounced on that, once again highlighting the 24-point lead that Governor Beshear holds in the polls over Senator Williams. So for this, you know, campaign, I guess, committee, it puts Senator Williams in an odd sort of way from a campaign standpoint on the same plateau with independent gubernatorial candidate Gatewood Galbraith, who also his campaign manager stepped down a few months ago, and he's running his campaign via committee.
And the Beshear campaign, or Governor Beshear, the Democratic nominee, got an endorsement this week from a Republican, a name we haven't heard for a while, Larry Hopkins.
Yeah. I think the governor has highlighted that he has gotten bipartisan support in this campaign. A number of Republicans have come out in support of his race, including former Jefferson County Republican Party chairman and now Metro Councilman John Ackerson. The Hopkins endorsement, for those who have a long political memory, is a former gubernatorial candidate. Hopkins' campaign manager was Senator David Williams. It's rather interesting that Hopkins ended up facing Larry Fogey in the Republican primary for governor back in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Now Senator Williams says that he was wrong in 91 and Fogey is right now. So mm-hmm. We have this weird situation where Senator Williams' former boss is endorsing the governor. Now, Hopkins has said this has nothing to do with any bad blood between him and Senator Williams, that he just feels that Governor Beshear is the right man for the job. Like I said earlier, the Beshear campaign is certainly highlighting this bipartisan support as, you know, Governor Beshear is someone who can unite all of Kentucky. I think it further highlights some of the issues going on with the Republican Party as far as the top of the ticket is concerned. It'll be interesting to see, for example, if the Republican Governors Association continues to run ads in support of Senator Williams bashing Governor Beshear, or if they begin to pull out and focus their money and their resources on other gubernatorial races around the country.
All right, Philip and Bailey, thank you. Gabe, have a couple of minutes to talk about two other big stories that you covered this week. One is the purchase or the pending purchase of Insight Communications.
Yeah. Insight had, for months, we'd been hearing that Insight was looking into various options for its future. One was that they might sell themselves. Insight is owned by the Carlyle Group. Majority share is owned by the Carlyle Group. But Insight had, in March, put itself up for auction very quietly. It hadn't discussed much of it. Last month, those bids came in, and the Wall Street Journal had found some people close to the deal who spoke off the record saying that the bids were a little lower than Insight had expected, that the auction was a little disappointing for them. But then earlier this week, we heard that Time Warner Cable, the second largest cable provider in the country, was going to purchase Insight. It's going to be about a $3 billion deal, could take 6 months to close.
Is it too early to tell what customers will notice with their TV or internet service?
Yeah, aside from the name changing from Insight to Time Warner, it's not really clear. The Time Warner folks are very quiet on this. They say it's premature to say what will happen. They are planning some significant cost savings in the hundreds of millions of dollars with this purchase. So there could be a lot of employees will be redundant. There may be some layoffs. They don't want to discuss that right now. They also can't discuss what will happen with the city's franchise agreement with Insight, which is currently expired and being negotiated. Some members of the Metro Council say it would probably be easier for the city to negotiate a favorable agreement with Insight before the sale. However, it's not really clear if that would still stand in the sale, if Time Warner would then have to negotiate a new one anyway. So that's something that's still being figured out. Exact service changes still being figured out as well. But Time Warner is gaining something in this aside from the 750,000 customers in Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio. They're also gaining a pretty fast internet network, which is something that a lot of these cable providers are trying to snatch up to be more competitive in the future.
We've also been reporting extensively on this proposed hospital merger involving the University of Louisville, and state lawmakers had a hearing on that topic this week.
Yeah, a joint committee on health called the principals from the merger from University of Louisville, University Medical Center, UofL Hospital, Catholic Health Initiatives, and Jewish Hospital all before the committee. Most of their questions, the committee was pretty critical. They asked a lot of questions about how reproductive services are going to be handled once University Hospital is owned largely 70% by Catholic Health Initiatives. The doctors in the hospital, even if they're not Catholic, will have to follow Catholic care directives. We'll put a link to what those exactly are on our website. But a lot of procedures that are technically legal under U.S. law are not allowed under the Catholic directives. So they wouldn't be allowed in this hospital. So there were a lot of questions over where those would still be provided. UofL officials have insisted that these services will stand. They're in talks with another group or another facility to provide tubal ligations after cesarean sections or tubal ligations in general. But other than that, there aren't a lot of details, and the committee was pretty harsh on that. I talked with Tom Birch, the co-chair. He says they'll probably be calling them back next year.
All right. Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, and Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us for our Friday news roundup on WFPL. Devin's going to be taking us on the magic of tape and audio tour of the Kentucky State Fair. You went out there yesterday and you came back in one piece.
Yeah, it was my first experience with the Kentucky State Fair. I was very impressed with the food and the animals. 228-pound watermelon. Yes,
wow.
If you want to see that, go check it out. Also, a lot of animals out there you could pet. It's fun.
All right. We'll hear from Devin. He'll hear Devin's tour of the State Fair a little bit later in the program. As we mentioned, Erica Peterson, WFPL's environment reporter, is in the coal fields of eastern Kentucky. She's been taking part in an EPA-sponsored tour of communities affected by the coal industry. And we spoke with Erica about her tour about an hour ago. So, Erica, where are you right now?
Well, right now I'm in Lynch, Kentucky, in Harlan County. I'm standing outside the Portal 31 mine, which is an old underground coal mine that they have made into a mine tour to attract tourists to the area.
So tell us about this tour. What is the EPA hoping to accomplish with this?
The EPA is billing this as kind of a listening environmental justice tour. The Region 4 Administrator, Gwen Keyes Fleming, was here, and she's only been the administrator for about a year, and she's been to eastern Kentucky already two or three times. So she's telling the residents here that she is making their concerns a priority. And they went to four different places in four different counties just to kind of hear what residents are saying.
And what are they saying?
Well, they're saying a lot of things. They're saying, for one, even though the politicians around here are, you know, suing the EPA and asking for less involvement from the EPA, the residents that showed up to these meetings were asking for more involvement. They want the EPA to do water testing and soil testing and air testing and all these other things to reassure them that their water and air is safe to drink and breathe. This stop in Lynch was the first time, the first three stops, there was nobody there who openly spoke up and in support of mountaintop removal. This time in Lynch, there was one person who did show up, as well as the city's police chief showed up to make sure there was order. And this person didn't speak at the meeting, but basically everyone at the meeting did qualify their statements. And they wanted to make it really clear that they aren't attacking coal. Most of them are former coal miners. They want to see underground mining done responsibly in their community. But in this particular community, they're worried about permits that would mine Black Mountain, which is the highest point in Kentucky, and this town is right at the base of Black Mountain.
Have you run into anybody from the coal industry at these meetings?
No, nobody is from the coal industry. There have been two people from the state, from the Division of Water, who followed around the entire tour, along with me and the EPA, and the tour was organized by members of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, so there have been a lot of KFCC members going along as well, but nobody from the coal industry and no politicians either.
Yeah, I would imagine there'd be somewhat of a hesitancy by some to speak out too harshly against the coal industry because it's been, you know, such the lifeblood of the economy out there.
Yeah, and that's one reason why a lot of people are saying, you know, they recognize that a lot of them are getting, you know, UMW pensions. The coal industry has put food on their table. A lot of them, if they weren't in the mines, they're the children of coal miners. But they feel really strongly that, you know, that mining is fine for their community, but they just don't want to see the environmental impacts they say will come if they do strip mine from these mountains.
So where are you headed today?
Well, today I am going to go on the underground mine tour in a little bit and see what that's all about. Poke around these towns a little bit more. They've got a coal mining museum as well. And then I am going to head a little bit north to talk to some people whose communities are pretty much destroyed from flooding.
And you're involved in this tour, but you're also gathering some tape and some information for some stories you're going to be doing for us.
Yes, of course.
Very good. What is the EPA going to do with this information that they gather? Will it be put into a report, or what's going to happen with that?
I don't know if they're going to issue a formal report. At the last stop, some people asked them some very pointed questions. They wanted to know, A, can they meet with the EPA again? And Administrator Gwen Q. Fleming said yes. That was the only question she actually gave a concrete response to. They also want to see more, you know, testing, as I mentioned, and she said they'll definitely look into that. She had her head of water here with her, So I don't know what exactly is going to come of it. Whether this is just kind of, you know, paying lip service to people's concerns, but they do seem to be taking them seriously, and, you know, see what they can do about it.
All right, WFPO's Erica Peterson in Eastern Kentucky. Erica, thanks for joining us, and safe travels.
Thank you, Rick.
Erica Peterson spoke to us about an hour ago from the coal fields of Eastern Kentucky, and she'll have numerous reports from her trip coming up here on WFPL. We're going to take a break. Still ahead, we're going to talk the stock market with David Widener of the Wall Street Journal, and we invite you to join the conversation, 814-TALK, that's 814-8255, or toll-free, 1-877-TALK, 1-877-8255. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, it's been an interesting ride, to put it lightly, over the past few weeks on Wall Street and the stock markets. And joining us now to talk about that is David Widener, who's Market Watch columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, David. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick. I wish you guys would have me when there's good news to talk about. But, you know, I'll take it.
So I'm almost afraid to ask about today. How's it going up there right now?
Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 57 points. It was up earlier this morning, which surprised a lot of people because there was a lot of negative sentiment coming out of Europe going into the opening bell. And so we rallied briefly, but we're down. But look, 59 points, and the S&P is down just 5. Considering what we've been through, that's a pretty stable, nice day. I don't think anybody's going to complain if we finish somewhere around that mark.
Yeah, things. I was listening to the news this morning. Things look pretty grim based on what was happening overseas overnight.
Yeah, it was, as I said, those futures were pointing to another steep drop. But I think what happened here in the U.S. is, you know, these market cycles sort of go around the world, you know, following the sun. And I think what happened was is that we've kind of caught up and that the U.S. is now kind of leading things. And I think there's a sentiment, it's Friday, there's a lot of people on vacation, that feeds into it. But that I think the feeling was, let's just put the brakes on this thing and we'll come back to it on Monday.
Took a big plunge yesterday, still those ongoing concerns about Europe.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, the concern now, or I think the two things really spooked the market yesterday. One was, of course, Europe, and there's concern among U.S. regulators about European banks in the U.S. And when we say, well, there's not that many European, well, there are very big European banks presence in the U.S. They may not be your local branch, but they're certainly involved in big banking on Wall Street, big banks like UBS, Credit Suisse, Societe Generale. These banks have a very big presence in our financial market. And just the idea that regulators are looking at them to see about their exposure to the sovereign debt crisis over there really hit some alarm bells for investors. And secondly, there was this Philly Fed manufacturing report that came out that was at a level that really surprised a lot of people. It was at a level that you don't really see unless you're in a recession. And I think those two things combined, you know, sent the market into a panic. I mean, the market was already jittery already, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks.
I was looking at a video posting, I think it was posted today, you had on your site, where you compare the years 1936 and this year, 2011. What are the parallels?
Well, you know, this is something that's being talked about a lot more. Really, the parallels are striking, and they're a little eerie and disconcerting. But basically what was happening in 1936, that was an election year, the economy was recovering. 1932 was really the bottom out of the first wave of that of the Great Depression, and GDP had been on the rise. Unemployment was still high, but it had come down significantly, about 7 percentage points, and that put it about 18%. I mean, you know, unbearably high, but it was making progress. So there was a lot of sentiment, and the market had rallied significantly too, not unlike we've seen over the last couple of years. So there was this sentiment that, you know, we were coming out of this. Maybe it's time to stop all of this controversial government intervention that Franklin Roosevelt had put into place, you know, with his work programs and that kind of thing. So basically what happened was that political sentiment changed, and the government, which was running a deficit at the time, said we need to move back towards a balanced budget. We need to quit spending this money. We need to cut back, and within 6 months, the market had tumbled again, and of course the depression extended all the way through to World War II, and all the government's moves after that seemed to have very little, if any, effect. So, especially in terms of how the stock market is performing, I think the parallels are very, very similar in that we kind of have this rally built on the thought that the economy will turn around, and then there's skepticism about whether that's really going to happen or maybe the government pulls back a little too soon. So I think that those are the obvious parallels. The big difference, I think, between 1936 and today is a couple of things. First of all, unemployment is nowhere near as high, so that's good for us. But one thing that is significantly different that really puts us in a corner is that back then the government really had a lot more room to borrow. The deficit was only about $4 billion. Well, you say, well, what about inflation? Well, that still would only be $670 billion a year this year. So it really had – its borrowing capacity was probably a lot more than we have today, because right now our borrowing capacity, we're at almost 100% of GDP. Back then it was 40%. So we're kind of – maxed out. We've maxed out our credit card in terms of the government stimulating the economy. And I think that that's, of course, playing into fears here, too, because obviously the government is talking, politicians are talking about cutting. They're not going to be spending money, pumping money into the economy. And we don't have a Federal Reserve now that seems to have any bullets left. They've kind of done their business. So that kind of leaves us out on our own, the business community out on its own. And I think investors are beginning to realize that, Rick.
I'm just glad you're not comparing this year with, say, October of 1929.
Well, you know, I can't say it's much better, and I wish I could say that, you know, but you know, the middle of the Depression was a very hard time for this country, as your grandparents will tell you.
Absolutely.
So let's not – a market crash is one thing, but that many people out of work, or as many people as we have out of work today, is pretty bad.
Just a minute or so left. What do you see happening over the next few weeks?
You know, I think it'll be interesting. There's nothing really on the horizon that would give the bulls, and I think there are still a few people out there who want to buy, who think that this is a great opportunity. There's not a lot going to be happening in the near future. There's no global conference. There's no, you know, big meeting over in the in the European Union. There's nothing happening in Washington that's going to turn things around. I think what investors should be looking at is the third quarter, and that's going to be October. Earnings seasons will start. Basically, what's been baked into the market right now is this idea that corporate earnings will not be strong. The third quarter could change people's opinion on that. If we see better than expected earnings, that could be enough of a lift to turn things around for investors and the stock market.
All right, David Widener with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, and good luck.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Take care, David.
Okay.
David Widener with the Wall Street Journal, Market Watch columnist. When we come back, we'll talk about Google Plus with Neil Ungerleiter of FastCompany.com. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, Google has gone into the social networking business, made a foray into social networking with Google Plus, and there have been some concerns raised about anonymity. And here to kind of clear that up for us and talk about it is Neil Ungerleiter with FastCompany.com. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the program. First, for those who don't know, what is Google Plus? Is it Google's version of Facebook, more or less?
That's correct. Google Plus is a social networking service that was launched by Google in July, and it's intended as Google's competitor to Facebook with two big differences. First, Google Plus is fully integrated with Google Search and Google's other services. And in addition, Google Plus has a video conferencing feature where you can talk by a video phone, kind of like Skype, with up to 10 other people at the same time.
Now, there have been concerns raised about anonymity, that you have to use your so-called real name with Google+. What are the differences between that and Facebook?
Well, Facebook has always said that they're against the concept of anonymity online. Facebook's Randy Zuckerberg has said multiple times in public forums that the idea of anonymity online is, in her words, an outdated concept. But at the same time, Facebook has turned a blind eye to anonymity. And if you go into the service, you'll see many users who use pseudonyms. This is especially the case for foreign countries or areas of the country where people could be put at risk by using their real names. However, Google Plus has been very aggressive about maintaining a real names only policy, and users who use pseudonyms, fake names, or anything of the sort have found their accounts quickly deleted.
So, this anonymity has been critical in places like Egypt and Syria, where there's been so much unrest, and that's been a way for people to communicate.
That's correct. In the cases of countries such as Egypt and Syria, Facebook did not pay too much attention to anything written in non-Latin alphabets. A user who would be writing their posts, writing their personal messages, what have you, in Arabic, would encounter virtually no censorship from Facebook. And as long as they used a method of communication with the outside world that was shielded from the Syrian or the Egyptian regime before the revolution, they would be largely safe.
All right, got about a minute left. What has Google's response been to some of these complaints about anonymity?
Google's exhibited a confused response to it. they've been insistent on the real names policy, but at the same time, there has been substantial blowback both within the company and from outside observers, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation and civil rights activists. The problem for Google Plus is that they're finding their users are very uncomfortable with the policy because it means people cannot criticize their employers online, people cannot talk about their health problems online without being at risk of other people finding out about them because of the simple risk that someone at Google or even at Facebook might slip up privacy settings and this information could become public.
All right, Neil Ungerleiter with FastCompany.com. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, just a few minutes left in the program, and as we promised, the 107th Kentucky State Fair began on Thursday. It brings in people from all over the state and even attracts an international crowd with its World Championship Horse Show. WFPL's Devin Katayama went to the fair and brought his recorder along to gather the sounds of opening day.
Welcome to the Kentucky State Fair. We hope that you enjoy your day here.
The Kentucky State Fair brings hundreds of thousands of visitors each year. Depending on your taste, you can see animals, catch a show, and eat foods that seem to surprise people every year.
Fried Kool-Aid. Never seen the deep-fried Kool-Aid before. Last year it was the Krispy Kreme hamburger. This year it's the deep-fried Kool-Aid.
Louisvillian Sean and Amanda Connor say there is no question whether they were showing up on the fair's first day.
Absolutely, yeah. That's probably the best time to come, really, because you got folks that are just starting with some of their exhibits and things like that, and you're just kind of getting the raw essence of what, you know, the state fair, because you're getting folks that are moving in and kind of getting excited, and they're not really tarnished yet. You know, as the week goes on, folks get tired or whatever. There's a lot of energy and things like that. So.
And the rain scared off the amateurs. We come first day every year, and this won't be our only trip to the fair either.
A big part of the fair is ribbon competitions. Pigs, pies, quilts, sheep, you name it, the Kentucky State Fair seems to have a contest for it. Raymond Kraft is a pigeon judge from Bowling Green. He grabs a pigeon from its cage and explains what he's looking for.
I don't want you to catch him. So let's look. Let's see here.
All right.
So far?
You also judge him on feather. And see, this one's molting.
To the untrained eye, all the birds look very similar. But to Kraft, the feather count, look, and feel of the bird all mean something.
When you get it in your hand, you judge it for how long the tail is, and one out of proportion will be too long, see?
The smells of cow hit your nose while venturing into one of the pavilions. Today, these cows will be judged in competitions. I found fifth grader Brian Woods from Boone County roaming the aisles. He names his cows for me.
Her name's Sweetie, Madison, Little Bear, Sissy, Fidget, Biscuit, and Princess.
Now, the last four or five cows that you just named all look very similar. Do you ever get them mixed up?
No. I knew their names since I was born, and I named them all, and I can tell because I named her Sweetie, and I named her Madison.
Well, how do you know that's Madison?
I just know it's her name.
11-year-old Carrie Conrad from Lewis County has a different naming convention.
Well, I got this whole system. I got three others at home. I'm going to name them in ABC order. So those are D and A.
She's also competing against Brian for showmanship.
Okay. I hope I beat you in showmanship.
I got something to say. Tomorrow, Fidget will beat her tomorrow. And I promise you.
Yeah, right.
Outside near the rides and games, Gary Conjure will guess your weight or your age. If he doesn't, you win a prize.
How old are you? How much do you weigh? When were you born? Walk in, fool me, and you pick it out.
I have a lot of fun here. They know what this game is here, and you can have a lot of fun here.
Yeah, a little more there than I thought.
A lot of places, if you go, if they don't know what this is, you can't have no fun with it. Like, if you come up and I guess your age and I guess her weight, then people get mad and they go get their cousins and they keep coming back. They want to get me.
I ask him if he has a secret.
There is none. You know what I'm saying? You look at people's, you know, body structure, you know, facial features. You just guess.
To sum up the Kentucky State Fair, I'll leave it to Harold Hunt.
We come every year. Just enjoy looking around, seeing the crowd, and looking at different exhibits. It's Kentucky. I like the fair because it represents so much of Kentucky in one place.
Bye. I like those waves. Appreciate that. And enjoy your day at the Kentucky State Fair.
All right, Freddy.
WFPL's Devin Katayama taking us on a tour of the Kentucky State Fair, which continues through August 28th. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on today's show, visit WFPL.org. You can also listen to the show again at our website. State of Affairs is produced by the WFPL news staff and includes Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson, and Graham Shelby. Our production team, led by Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, and Joe Durso. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend.